But it brings back some nostalgic feelings to me when I recall the time when I sat in his class and experienced him in the student-teacher-professor relationship. Dr. Tweedy is a very warm man, an outgoing man, and a man that I've come to appreciate in a very deep sense. We've tried to entice him to our campus before. We're not able to do so, but this time he was able to come. And it's just a delight to have him with us. Some of the writing, the books that he's written, will be available, or is available, in the bookstore at the break time, if you care to look that material over and buy it. And as I understand, he is working on a manuscript for the material that he's presenting today, at least part of the material. And no doubt that will be available in the future. Perhaps he'll want to say something about that. Also the fact that he's been one of the leaders in the area of Christian psychologist and promoter in that area, and I've asked him to speak a few words to that end. Dr. Tweedy, it's a delight to have you here and to share the day with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Jack. Did I put that around my name?
Yeah.
Well, looks like we're all wired up now, so I can present myself to you. It's a very special privilege for me to be here. I've not been even in the area more than a fleeting time or two out of the Renton Airport and fleeting by on my way to Bellingham. It is a real privilege also personally to be back with Jack and to see the institution which he has been for a decade, he tells me, involved. And I appreciate the memory of interacting with him in class. He was a very special and very good student. He mentioned something about area of Christian psychology, and I'll make a little bit of a plug now to fulfill a promise I made to the executive secretary of WACPUS, which is the Western Area, Western Association for Christians and Psychological Studies. This has to do with the area of psychology, psychiatry, sociology, and pastoral care. And I told him I'd put in a plug. We were having our annual meeting in June in San Francisco area this year and in Seattle area next year. If any of you are interested in involving yourselves in this group of persons who are of like precious faith and gathered together betimes to learn more about each other's behavior in the area. So much for commercial. I heard a wag say one time, or perhaps I read it, that marriage is a great institution and fools will learn in no other. At the time, it seemed more of a joke than it appears to be now in terms of the social despair or the instability of this great institution of marriage. First topic, as we enter into the discussion of ministering to the married couple, is mate selection and marital growth. Just a little bit by way of background in terms of marriage and the biblical attitudes or assumptions that seem to be related to it. Probably no other analogy or illustration is used more consistently in the development of biblical theology and the biblical account as is the account of marriage. It seems to be, in fact, the very initial focus of the biblical revelation. And so we see through the Bible that the great historic doctrine of creation, redemption, sanctification, and the eschaton are related in the concept of marriage. As a matter of fact, it seems that the very focal point of creation, one of the high points, is that which took place on the sixth day, where God said, "Let us make man in our own image, and in the image of God made he them, male and female, blessed them and told them to multiply." So right at the very beginning, not only does it seem to be that the focus of creation has to do with creating man as male and female for marriage. And what almost blows my mind, to use one of my kids' expressions, is the fact that this seems to be somehow related to the very image of God, the very nature of God, as though God were a family, God were a marriage, God were a relationship. In the image of God made he them, male and female. Blessed them, told them to multiply. So the focus of creation has to do with marriage. And then some of the great biblical themes having to do with redemption relate in illustration to Jehovah God and Israel and Christ and the church as being something of the illustration or analogy of redemption. Israel was redeemed, selected by Jehovah God as his bride. Christ and the church, a marriage. Not only so, but also in the Ephesian letter and in other account of Paul in the New Testament, the sanctifying graces of learning how one should be in obedience and loving in his relationship of Christian growth is just like Christ and the church. And then the final denouement of history, that final thing, the eschaton, the focus of eschatology is also a marriage, where it is said in this highly symbolic account of the Revelation, but interesting to us as we think about marriage, when the Lamb will take a bride. That apparently is the whole focus of the historical process to come to that point where a marriage is going to take place. Nuptials are going to be held and had as the Lamb takes his wife. So creation and redemption and sanctification and the eschaton relate in some important, thematic, significant way to the ways of a man and a maid who enter into matrimony. And so the Bible presents this as a very important institution, and also one that is so solemn in its engagement that it is to be in perpetuity. It is to last forever, or at least until death do them part. That is the intention for it. Very significant kind of a thing in terms of the biblical data. It is also so in terms of social data. It is the basal social unit, marriage. There are other social units that are very important. The church, industry, the government, education, but the home. That is the very focus. There have been cultures which have tried to neutralize the effect of this unit in the social process in China in the 50s and in Russia in the 20s, to no avail. The family is the very center. Almost always, at least proportionally, this agency, institution of marriage is entered into with a solemn promise, even more stringent than the vow of your postman. Neither storms, nor dark of night, nor Hades or high water, even if the creek do rise, will cause a person who marries another to separate. Almost everyone enters in it, and that's a high, not only a high and solemn vow, but there is good, clear, enthusiastic intention. And those persons think that, boy, other people may have instability in their marriage, but nobody could feel like I do and waver one whit in the growth of this relationship. Other people are unstable in themselves, but my vow is in perpetuity. Well, we know very well that there's a whole lot of trouble in the marriage. About in the United States as a whole, about 40% of people who make that vow find their marriages dissolved before they've had a Sabbath of anniversaries. But they are not daunted, and they take heart and say they just happen to choose the wrong one. There was some incompatibility in personalities, more abrasive than they had thought or ever dreamed of. And if God is disappointed in a broken marriage, he'd be more disappointed in two people who didn't love each other to live together. And so with that apparently impeccable logic in their own thinking, they break it up and try over again. But if you think first marriages are unsuccessful, second marriages, 60% of them fail. And so these persons, marriage, no matter what the solemn promise is, very often ends in failure. Marriage in America and around the world is in trouble, even in the church. Very focally and disappointingly in the church at times. Well, how does it all get started anyway? Through a process the sociologist called meat selection. Now, that seems a little more formal than what happens in your gizzard when you first look at some fair young maiden or some stalwart young man. And there is that emotional surge that is related to the autonomic nervous system as it moves into a sympathetic phase, sometimes called butterflies in your stomach. But in any case, that pleasant sinking sensation when you lock on with your eyeballs to some person of the opposite sex and you start feeling, maybe this is the one. What an attracting and attractive person. Meat selection. Now, how does it go about? From the point of view of the sociologist, it has to do with certain sociological variables. You have to live more or less in the same area, although we're mobile more than we have been ever as a population, as a social process. More or less the same amount of brains, more or less the same amount of money, more or less the same ethnic background, religious attitudes. These seem to be the factors that draw people into what is known as a mate selection or marriage pool. And it's based upon what is called ethnocentricity. That is, you marry somebody like you in terms of where you live and what you think and how you're educated and how much money you've got and what your parents want and where you go to church. But apart from this, there also, you can't marry somebody too close to you. You have to marry somebody close to you, but not too close. Every culture has its taboo. You can't marry your mother. You can't marry your sister, even though it would be very efficient to do that. You probably wouldn't even have to leave home, but you can't do it. You can't marry your aunt if she happens to be your mother's sister or your daddy's sister. Other kinds of aunts, I guess there are some, is possible to marry them. But even in spite of the old hillbilly song where the guy went through the very mixed-up genealogy of his family life and came out to the fact that he was his own grandfather, even if that's the case, there are certain people who are too close to you to marry. So you can't marry them when they're too close in terms of the incest taboo, and you marry them close enough so that you have interaction and social evaluation that relates to them. Now, why is it that out of this pool, there is that one who is very attracting and attractive, and through a course of events that's called courtship, you come to say, will you? And they say, I will. And then you gather together in this solemn promise, usually in a church, where you promise God and your friends and the pastor and each other and any other powers that may be in terms of personality that you do. And that generates the marriage. Now, what is there about this so-called chemistry or attraction? Why this person rather than that person? Why, how do you get together? There is a certain sense in which you choose someone who is like you, but apparently there's another sense in which you choose somebody who is not like you. The understanding of it that most appeals to me in terms of my clinical experience, my understanding of social dynamics and personal dynamics, is that there what is called the complementary need hypothesis. We marry persons whom we believe in some important way will fulfill us as personalities. We're drawn to them and we think that if I could filter my life and its experiences through this person, then life would have meaning, and it would have excitement, and it would have ecstasy, and it would have expectations that would be a whole lifetime full. And without this person, life would be drab, maybe even meaningless, at least a kind of a martyring existence. So says the heart in love. It appears that there is a certain sense in which the person to whom we are drawn is different than we are. If a person tends to be conservative and maybe a bit compulsive, he tends to be affected with some particular powerful motivation by someone who is carefree and easygoing and uninhibited and may create some problems. But in courtship, it seems just so ideal and idyllic, that possibility that with this one, life would have great ministry and great meaning. There is this anticipatory pleasure that Eden revisited is not far away, if only they'll say, "I do." The anticipation is heady and makes you impatient and longing and sometimes careless, indiscreet. But the anticipation is that of a high pleasure and its fulfillment. Now, the actual story is not exactly, "and they lived happily ever after." The old Hollywood movies seem to indicate that, and some of the less grim of Grimm's fairy tales. But most of them are just that. They are fairy tales. They are a cultural mythology because mostly that pleasant anticipation is caught up in some very difficult adjustment experiences, and you find that while this person in courtship had so many attributes and assets that you wanted to incorporate, you find some of them are like burrs under your saddle. They do not wear so well. They do not feel so good. They bring frustration. For instance, I was utterly attracted to a young girl whom I saw across the dance floor at a high school social that I attended 35 years ago last month. And I really liked the looks of her. We did a number called Count Seven, and then the Grand March, and then waltzed a little bit. I didn't know that she was in the local grammar school. I thought she was from another high school. But I could be forgiven that distorted assumption, since she was 5'6" and weighed about 138 pounds, and she was really in full bloom. Never occurred to me she was in the eighth grade. But in any case, I discovered that she had two brothers, and I made myself of them a close friend. Didn't really care much for them before then, but then I did. And her lilting personality, carefree, easygoing, intuitive, didn't seem to care whether school kept or not. And 4 years later, I married her with the same enthusiasm that I had met her the first time. And I couldn't stand her. Because carefreeness, when you marry it, becomes carelessness. And while it seems so droll and funny to be in her parental home, and the lights were left on, and the doors were left open, and the water was left running, and you just, if you're hungry, you eat. Dinner time, lunch time, none of those things make any difference. You live. That was a great experience in courtship. I couldn't tolerate it at all in my home. You're supposed to turn out lies. God gave engineers or inventive characters the genius to make door hinges and door knobs so that you could shut doors. And while it seemed very droll to live so casually in her home, as a matter of fact, you could guess probably what she would do with a tube of toothpaste. Just take the cap off, and that'd be the last time she'd care about the cap, and squeeze it right in the middle. And the reason she was drawn to me, because I was a bit of a rascal and goal-directed, carried things out, thought logically, planned projects, and you marry a character like that, and instead of security and stability under his aegis, you are married to a compulsive nag. Somebody who will tell you 1,000 times to turn out the light. Somebody who is stomach turns and is wrenched by such a simple social behavior as squeezing toothpaste right in the middle. Who is convinced that God would never do that. And is about easily to tell you that. The strange thing, what attracts you repels you. What draws you to somebody makes it difficult to live with. What at a distance in the romantic aura of courtship is such an impelling, compelling, drawing thing that somehow if you were like that, you would be a full person, a fuller and more complete personality. You see those behaviors and those idiosyncrasies as egocentric, something with you, and you want them. And there is a repulsion reversal, a kind of an attraction-repulsion factor that enters in and causes that relationship to be difficult. And what you thought would make your heart sing makes it mad, angry, at least irritable, even if your mouth is silent about it. And so that idyllic anticipation of what the bliss of wedded relationship is to be like often founders, and strangely, right on the same factors that seem to make it so promising. And what more blows my mind, and the reason that second marriages are less stable than first marriages, is because when you dissolve your relationship because of your frustration with this one whose behavior you thought would be so fun and now it's so terrible, it's so foul, you court another person on those same grounds. I talked with a woman not too many moons ago who is engaging herself to a number three. I mentioned that in the United States as a whole, it's nearly 40% breakdown in marriages where they are legally dissolved. And for second marriages, nearly 60%. That's a very conservative figure in terms of California, my state of legal residence. We do it up really good there. 3 years ago, and it's now worse, in a study of persons who were married in San Mateo County, which is a very highly populated county just below San Francisco, of every 1,000 persons who got married, 763 of them would be divorced. And that's, I would presume, less than now would break up on the shoals of wedded bliss. So not only is there this factor in human relationships where what you desire to fulfill your heart in some strange way is difficult to adapt, and persons, many of them, many Christians in our culture, I counsel all of the time, over the years, with dozens, yea, hundreds of persons who are evangelical Christians, who love the Lord, and who believe His Word, at least by their testimony, who get so frustrated that they say, God help me, I want out. So it's not just the fact that all of the people who are unbelievers break up their relationships, and that small remnant left are us. We have contacted the enemy in the area of marital conflict, as Snoopy says, and it is us. And the repetition factor is that people do it right over again. And I think it's because there's something very basic to different personality temperaments, that in some important facet they are drawn together because the person believed they would be whole and big and fulfilled and fulfilling and able to minister, cutting a wider swath, that in the relationship, in its intensity of ongoing activity, becomes difficult and despairing, disappointing, deteriorating, destroying, and defunct. Now, what can we do? What can we do in a church? I suppose there are two things, possibly, or it would seem logically might do. Get these people so they understand better what the commitment of marriage is all about through premarital counseling. Well, that's one of the problems. Now, pastors, those of you who put in a clincher or a contingency before you'll marry up anybody, that I won't marry unless you come see me 3 times for marriage counseling. And they usually don't respond, "Oh, goody, I was afraid you wouldn't ask." And we've just been looking forward, where we're just so uncertain about our relationship that we just needed counseling. Can we come more than 3 times? They look at each other. They thought you were going to just talk, give them a sex book and tell them what the arrangement is in your church, who pays the organist, and do they bring their own soloist. And you want to counsel with them. Well, the only possible thing that you could do as far as they're concerned is break them up. Because they know what their hearts say. They don't have to ask you, "Are you sure you want to?" Sure. Is Lake Washington right over there, or isn't it? I'm surer than that. And it's pretty hard to even enter into very much dialogue with somebody, even theoretically questioning something about which they are so sure and secure. So I don't know whether we're running a study now to see whether there are different ways. We have 7 different denominational groups, the largest church in the area of each one of them, and trying to work some premarital counseling through pastoral leverage with every couple that gets married through all of those 7 large churches. And we're not too optimistic, because they know, they couldn't believe that these differences would make a difference, because that's what makes it so nice. Possibly one of the better things that we could do in terms of effort would be to get ourselves involved in marriage enhancement. Very great movement that many persons who are not of that particular Christian faith, the Roman Catholic group, have nonetheless, along with many of their Roman Catholic brethren, really enjoyed coming to terms with their marriage through the marriage encounter movement, other kinds of marriage enhancement, retreats, seminars on how to be happily married. All of these things. I think this is more fruitful, although I myself have not been professionally very much involved in such of these, except in terms of church retreats occasionally. So before we begin our discussion, I would like to just review for you in simple form how important marriage is, in my judgment, It is the reason man was created, and it is his primary vocation. If he does not enter into it, my understanding of the scripture is that it is as an exception for specialized service, and that there is something about this relationship that is related to the image of God. The image of God is in some important way a marriage. And you can't really say, in terms of the understanding of biblical theology, that how can that be when Christ is our model for behavior as well as our Redeemer through His grace, that He never got married. The whole of Revelation history is an account of the courtship of Jesus Christ. And it winds up, according to the Scripture, in His wedding. It is the significant theme that consistently runs through the Scripture, and God says, this is my plan, and when you enter into it, don't anybody disrupt this relationship in human affairs. And almost everybody agrees with that, even if they are unbelievers. And we see, however, in the exigencies of human affairs and in the very complex process of contemporary human flow, even in the church, it is one of the most unsuccessful kinds of relationships that there is extant. It may be, if my judgment is right, that the very reason that we are attracted to one rather than another is also the reason that we find difficulty in the interaction. 4 years did I court my wife, waiting until she got through high school. Meantime, I was in the service, helped with some of my impatience, just because Uncle Sam told me to be a long ways away. And then we got married. And then we got separated. And then we were engaging ourselves in divorce. I didn't want to perjure myself, and so we didn't get divorced at that time. And then, in a marvelous way, Christ came into my life. And I was redeemed and converted and diverted back into this marriage, which has been the delight of my heart for 31 years and the bane of my existence. It is, in a sense, a dialectic of growth, that its delights and its difficulties face me all the time. And I just think I've got it made. When we find that we're still two different persons, I haven't become one at all. And then, in a day or two, we become one and even almost forget. What trivial thing was the focus of our conflict? And there's something about that experience, that some weather better than others, and others weather not at all. That is the real stuff of growing up. And so, from the point of view of pastors and Christian persons at large, this is a very important topic. And if there is some way that we can understand ourselves, because there's a sense in which there is a great divine analogy here, you want to know God? You struggle in a marriage and you're beginning to know, insofar as you have gracious experiences in it, you're beginning to know something about the life of God and His relationship to you. must do something if we can to make this transition and adjustment easier and maintained. Because even if the initial adjustment is easy, something always seems to come along to start making it difficult again. In the next hour, we'll talk about the specific focus of marital conflict in terms of which some kind of counseling or psychological intervention may be pertinent in terms of its theory and background. And then this evening, we'll talk about a specific one in application that I have developed for the past 10 years, called it covenant therapy. But it may be that before then, and according to the schedule and before the coffee break, that we could have some discussion now just in terms of marriage as such, the biblical assumptions that seem to underlie it, the psychological difficulties that may be almost intrinsic to the relationship of spouses,